You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.
Char Miller is Director of Environmental Analysis, the WMCAC Professor of Environmental Analysis and History at Pomona College. His books include Natural Consequences, Intimate Essays for a Planet in Peril, West Side Rising, How San Antonio's 1921 Flood Devastated a City and Sparked a Latino Environmental Justice Movement, and Hetch Hetchy, A History in Documents. His new book is Burn Scars, A Documentary History of Fire Suppression from Colonial Origins to the Resurgence of Cultural Burning. Thank you for joining me, Char.
Well, thank you, Rick, for having me. It's fun to be on again.
This is a really fascinating book. What made you decide to create an anthology of documents as opposed to just go out and, you know, stake your claim mm-hmm. in like either a shorter paper or a longer screed, as it were?
Yeah. So it was kind of deliberate on the one hand. I wrote the book. The book was created in fire. And I don't need to tell people on K-Squid just exactly what 2020, 2021, 22 looked like. Every sky was dark orange. It was terrifying. It was down here in Southern California as well as, you know, Washington and other places. It's the midst of the pandemic. And so, like my book, Natural Consequences, I was sitting in my office going, well, now what do I do? I have no students. Where are they? Okay, they're not here. Let's try to do something. And as the fires blew up everywhere, I knew about the history of fire management, but what I didn't know and thought my students and I might have fun working on and thinking through was how we got to this place. Why are these fires burning now? And are there historical antecedents that we can trace in the human record? That is to say, documents of one form or another, cultural conversations, imagery, and the like. And it was pretty clear that all of those things were at play in Eastern Oregon and Western Oregon and elsewhere that were burning at the time, and particularly, the peninsula, the Santa Cruz Mountains. And it occurred to me that what I didn't know was the string of documents and the array of them. And I have to say, was very fortunate during the pandemic when a bunch of universities decided they didn't know what to do either. And so their librarians started digitizing stuff. So as I started to look for documents, it turns out they were all getting digitized. I was like, okay, this is great timing because I would have never found these things. Which means I could go back and did go back deep into the 19th century to find early white settler commentary about fires, to wrestle with the ways in which indigenous contemporary fire managers were talking about it, and they were writing constantly in The Guardian and elsewhere. And so the book sort of bloomed forth. And then the real trouble was, how do you cut stuff that you know is really important? But I had hundreds of documents and had to make those kinds of editorial decisions, but it was important to work on, I hope it is to read.
This is a really interesting look at not just the history of California and the forests and the fires, but also I think a really important look at a cultural document, a document about the cultural evolution of fire science and science in general. Talk about how you felt unearthing, you know, the shifting views of scientists who are certain they were right when they were probably actually absolutely wrong.
Yes. Yeah. That was, as you say, that's a thread that runs through the book, looking at the way in which Western scientists, beginning in the 19th century, were pretty convinced they knew what the dilemmas were, One of the key examples of this is Gifford Pinchot, who was the founding chief of the U.S. Forest Service. But before the Forest Service was invented or created in 1905, in 1899, he wrote this very insightful essay for Natural Geographic, in which he actually lays out what we know to be contemporary-like analyses of fire ecosystems for major trees like longleaf pine and other species that require fire to regenerate. And I'm going through this going, but this isn't the Gifford Pinchot I knew and have written about. This is like amazing. And I don't know why I didn't run into this article years earlier when I was writing about him. And then I got to the last sentence. And the last sentence is, despite all of this, this is a paraphrasing, the Western fires need to be suppressed. It's like, wait a second, you were just writing that the science tells us that these ecosystems need fire to regenerate. But so here we have both a scientific history on the one hand that often came to the conclusion that suppression of all fire was good because what foresters needed to do was to produce wood fiber. And if you let it burn, you can't do the thing you're supposed to do. So therefore, fire suppression is good. That's effectively what Pinchot was doing. If we were going to allow forests to be natural, fire, of course, but that's not what we were about. And that became a kind of paradigmatic muffling, smothering of other dissenting points of views that really drove much of the dialogue well through the 1920s among Western scientists. Didn't convince indigenous fire managers who continued to burn because that's what they knew to do and why they did it, because of the resources that they gained from the use of fire. But that's one setting. The other setting is this paradigm, like all paradigms, bore the seeds of its own destruction. And slowly people began to recognize, scientists, that, you know what? In Florida, you actually need to burn for fires, for those longleaf pine plantations of one form or another to actually regenerate and regenerate well. And so one of the things that a number of historians have pointed out is the very Forest Service that was suppressing fire also had these scientists who were sort of bubbling up, mostly in the South, but not only there, who went, nah, that doesn't work in this ecosystem. It doesn't work in Alabama. It doesn't work in Florida. It doesn't work in Louisiana. It sure doesn't work in Eastern Texas. And so they're at war with themselves, these people. And one of the figures that becomes really interesting is a person like Aldo Leopold, who was darn sure suppression was essential, but by the 1920s is sort of hedging his bets on that one, except in an essay that he wrote about Arizona, the close of it, he goes, yes, but California is different. Like, no one wanted to touch the fire suppression crazies in California because the Forest Service was absolutely convinced that you had to do it in California. That too would finally break. And so part of your point, and it's a good one, is that science changes its mind. It reaches new conclusion based on real data as opposed to ideological presumptions. And once that happened, it became really crucial for Western framing scientists that you have to bring fire back into the land, an idea that, of course, is indigenous to this landscape long before there was ever the creation of a Forest Service.
You write that the book was conceived, researched, and written in Toyangar, the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Gabriel Tonga people's landscape that encompasses greater Los Angeles Basin. How and why did you do that?
Well, I think one of the things that in sort of contemporary history is that practices of contemporary history is you identify the landscapes that were here before you and the people who were here before you. But I do it as well because the Tongan people of Southern California, like the Ohlone and the Central Coast, like the Colville tribes in Eastern Washington, they all burned. The understanding now about fire management in California is depending on the ecosystem, indigenous people burned it upwards to 15% annually. We don't get anywhere close to that. I mean, as one of the Spanish explorers along the coast called the San Diego Bay, he called it the Bay of Smoke. There was so, I mean, we think of it as smog. They were burning because they wanted cultural material, religious ritual material, food, and other kinds of things. And so part of the struggle I had for the book is to both think about my place as a non-Indigenous historian writing about Indigenous fire management practices, which I very quickly realized, go to the contemporary Indigenous fire managers. They're writing like crazy. Utilize them in this text. But the other source for this as a kind of foundational was, as it turns out, not surprisingly, the Spanish missionaries who wrote endlessly about fire as they worked their way up the coast of California, getting up to the Bay Area. And the amount of times they reference fire-burned landscapes is overwhelming. And you know, for an environmental historian to see people who whose eyes I get to look through and observe what they're observing was kind of a thrill to recognize that there were these journalists or journey, whatever you call them, diarists and letter writers who were actually making the case for me. I don't have to make it. They made it already in the 18th century. And so, go ahead. Well, I was going to say the fascinating thing about those documents is that California-based U.S. foresters went back to read it and completely discounted what the Spanish missionaries said and said they couldn't tell the difference between dry grass and burned grass. Because if it was true that Indigenous people were burning, then the Forest Service had to recalibrate its assumptions about fire and its damage. And so they basically said the missionaries were lying. Like, I read that and it was like, oh, I got to get this into the book. Because here are two different sets of settler societies thinking about fire in such dramatic ways. Now, the Spanish ultimately, as I have in the book, also recorded their efforts to suppress fire. But it was a very different set of reasons. Their reasoning wasn't about forestry. It was, if you take the firebrand out of the hand of an Indigenous person, they no longer can function in the world. They will, as one of them said, let's denaturalize them and raise them up into Christianity. But to do that, you got to get rid of fire. It's the same characteristic of wiping out the buffalo herds so that you can control the Plain Indians in California in the West, where fire was essential for lots of reasons. You take the fire away and you can control the people that were on the ground.
One of the things that I found reading the book that I thought was really interesting was the way that the assumptions of all of the settlers, whether they be Spanish or American, they would see the Indians and immediately assume that they weren't civilized and they knew nothing. And part of this was because of the forest management practices in Europe are very different. In fact, they do rake away the stuff under the eaves of the trees. But the assumption was as soon as they saw a civilization and a science that was different from what they were used to, they assumed that's not civilization, that's not science. Right. And completely discounted. So talk about, you know, I love the way you architect the exposure of perception in this book. You by choosing your entries and the way you order them up and introduce them and edit them, you give us a really great picture of how these different civilizations saw one another. On one hand, the Spaniards and the Americans later on both saw the Indians as uncivilized and lazy, essentially, while the Indians just said, well, what the heck? These people who are just coming are clearly stupid and crazy, and we'll keep doing what we keep doing.
Yeah, and fire, weirdly, is a great way to see this. And it's weird because, I mean, fire, like floods, is ephemeral. They come and they go. They don't leave a record necessarily, unless you're fighting a fire, for example, that is, quote, permanent, right? It's not like you've got necessarily documents that lay these stories out, but you can read the land that way. You can read not just fire rings, but also watching practices of different sets of people and the conversations that then emerge around them. As much as we've talked about sort of the evolution of science, this is also a cultural conversation about what fire means, how its meaning is manifest on the ground and in people's lives, and the ways in which in 2023, 24, those conversations are quite different. And, because you and I live in pretty heavy fire zones, this is part of our daily discourse, is especially during this now elongated fire season. We're having these conversations about what we need to do to minimize fire invading, sweeping into neighborhoods and the like. And that's a very different conversation than foresters once had, because back in 1900, the natural resource, that forest, was in a place where there were very few people. Today, Los Angeles has got, LA County is 10 million plus people. You have to have a very different conversation about fire in that context, or in San Diego, or in the larger Bay Area, than you might have had in another time. So I'm sitting in this position thinking about the arguments that emerged across the 19th century, and recognizing, even as I can articulate, and I love your language of architecture, because I was thinking very much about how do I put this together so that someone reading this in 2024 actually can immerse themselves in the dialogue that is not theirs, that is to say, an earlier time in a different place, because the constraints and opportunities in those places are quite dramatically different from our own. And that's where using primary sources really helps. The goal was to make them intriguing enough that people would want to read them. Sure. Turns out the writers back in the day were intriguing enough. I didn't need to jazz up their story. And so one of the ways to read this is to see that the past is a different country, effectively, but also to see ourselves in the conversation. They were wrestling with this concept of fire. It required them to suppress fire if that's what they wanted to do, and also suppress other people in the process, both indigenous and non-indigenous. And that was one of the other fascinating things for me, was noting that the moment the Forest Service started to articulate its fire suppression policies, it got resistance, not just from indigenous fire people, polities, but also from white ranchers and miners and those who recognized that fire actually was a tool.
And they were on back the landscape. They were there. They weren't somewhere else theorizing about what was good or bad. They were actually living there.
Right.
Now, one of the fascinating perceptions, and it just made me think about the way I think about things now, was I live right near a lot of forests. I think of them as forests. I think of them as natural resources, places you can go to recreate, to be close to nature, to just disconnect from your everyday life. What I don't think of, and never have actually thought of in my life, is forests as crops. And now I realize, obviously, I'm sitting at a wooden desk. I'm in a house that would burn in a heartbeat because there's a heck of a lot of wood in it. So wood is a crop. But the way that the Forest Service and the people in the United States government saw these forests, they just thought of them as a large corn crop that happened to be growing naturally. And if a fire goes through a corn crop, of course you want to stop it. Well, maybe, but so talk about just the perceptions of, the first Americans coming across the continent. They didn't see national parks. What they saw were resources.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's at the heart of certainly this settler colonial vision of the United States, that the land is part of it. Now, I actually was doing this in class the other day, yesterday, in fact. My students and I were talking about the way in which those perceptions of what might be here then was translated into policies about what wasn't there, right? So they're coming across like Nebraska or wherever. They go up into those mountains and they see these incredible forests in the Rockies and the Sierra, the Cascades, and other places. And for them, these were resources, wood fiber that would build the new nation as it extended westward. For the indigenous folks who were there and are still there in these landscapes, landscapes are resources to be sure, but you steward them in a very different way, and your relationship to them is therefore manifoldly different. And so we see not just a sort of a clash of cultural perceptions, but then because of those cultural perceptions, behaviors are manifest in different ways. And so, yes, they thought of timber as a crop because that crop built their houses and it built ours, let's be honest. And so wood fiber is essential. And it wasn't the distinctions are vast, but at the base, we're talking about two societies that utilize resources in different ways, but they utilize resources. They manage the environment to suit their needs. And what we see is a clash of different needs, not so much as such diametrically opposed social ambitions, but really, I want to take that thing down and put it down in the economy in a different way than you do. But when American society dominates, if that's the dominant culture, then it's going to assert its dominance through the Forest Service on the one hand or Park Service on the other, depending on sort of the sort of articulation of what an agency does and what it manages.
It's really just a joy to read these different passages, and I'll just start out with one. Juan Crespi, Diary, July 20, 1766 to October 17, 1766. Thursday, July 20, 1768. We set out at about 7 in the morning, which dawned cloudy, and taking the road straight to the north, we traveled by a valley about 1 league long with a good land, grassy, and full of alders. I mean, this just puts us right in the shoes of the people who are like first riding out here and going, wow, this is really cool. We can do a lot with this.
No, that's exactly right. And you know, they are both observing and simply observing and recording what they observe. But what the Spanish did everywhere they went was to record also for another set of reasons. Where would a mission be well situated to utilize these resources? Where are the indigenous people that we will want to convert to agricultural labor and other kinds of things, and to Christianity, of course. And so there's lots of levels at which their eyes are watching. And I loved those diaries for that reason. And coming across other sort of extracts from other missionaries, in part because I'm a voyeur. I like watching how other people watch. That may not be a voyeur, but you know, I'd really like to see what they're seeing and then start to think about what that means, and for them, and thus for us as sort of secondary observers. But you're right, the way they came to dominance was to be able to really assess and map and survey the lands that they went through. And it's not by happenstance that they also went with military forces, engineers, whose job it is to assess those things, obviously to protect the missionary, sure, but they're also coming with the tools of a military organization. When it moves, it's looking. It's trying to figure out where high and low ground is and what the resources are and what the rivers are doing, and how we might imagine ourselves planting a mission in this landscape to survive it.
What you said, but just really interested me. It made me realize how important engineering is to conquest.
Yeah.
I mean, it is as core a part of conquest as the military aspect.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And you can, you know, it's better imagined, although you can see it with these guys. I mean, when I lived in San Antonio, I was reading similar kinds of accounts. But what's also interesting is the moment they hit water, they stopped and they evaluated the water's flow to see whether you could build a city there. These guys in California weren't quite doing that because that you know, they were going to build their missions and whatever it was. But in the same time period that they're cruising up and down the California coast in Texas and elsewhere, they're doing a serious calibration. And it's the military, not the missionaries, who are going, we can build a city here. And then you can have both a civilian population and a missionary population, and obviously a presidio, a fort, which are sort of the three the tripartite things that the Spanish developed. So yeah, no, and I think engineering, if you think about it at a later context, you know, pushing the railroads across the United States, those continental routes, engineers built those things and they preceded them. And without them, those rail lines would not have been built. So they were really kind of handmaidens to empire.
What there are not a lot of documents that the Indians themselves left, but what was left is enough to give a really fascinating picture of a super sophisticated science, understanding of ecology that is, I think, equal to or greater than what we currently have, because they would manage to use the fire in such a fine way and create these kind of checkerboard effects over the different parts of the landscape.
Yeah.
Talk about, you know, the deep understanding of the landscape and a science that is far in advance of the science possessed by the Spanish and American invaders, as they were at the time. The Aboriginal understanding of environmental science was way ahead of the Western invaders, who brought a different kind of science that would just essentially try to steamroll over what was there and impose what they had were familiar with.
Yeah, I think, and you find this globally. And I think the first place to start is about how long they lived on this land. 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 years, you can learn a lot about a landscape over that time. You can learn a lot about how you both can manage it and not, and what benefits you can get and not, and why fire becomes a really critical tool to produce the kinds of things that you want at a proliferation and a rate that you need. And so part of what was fascinating to me in picking my way through these Spanish colonial records, which are really the literary way by which we get to know, the literate way we get to know some of this. As you pointed out, there's a patchwork that unfolds. There is green grass, there is burned grass, there is not burned grass. And the Spanish are recognizing that there is this process. They don't ask why. Why are they doing this in the ways that they will, once they settle down, they will begin to notice patterns that they don't like, as we've already talked about, that you want grain? This is how you do it. You want ritual objects? This is how you do it. But the Spanish don't want those ritual objects. They have their own ritual objects. And so there's that kind of debate. But the sort of genius of the diaries in the 18th century is that it gives us a way to see this. And then there are also in the book a collection of early to mid 19th century white or non-Indigenous writers that I located, who were not only deeply sympathetic to Indigenous fire management, but recognized its value. And it's those voices that will get squelched when agencies step in and say all fire is bad at all times and in all ways, and it has to be suppressed wherever you see it. But it's those kind of little moments where I went, Oh, this is not simply a dominant culture asserting its will, though it did. Because by the sides of this, and already in the middle of it, there are these other folks whose voices are articulating, also white settlers who are articulating why fire mattered, and often rationalized their point of view based on what they believed the indigenous people of their landscapes also did. And why did they know they did it? Because they watched them do it. It wasn't as if indigenous fire managers disappeared. They were burning as regularly as possible. And early versions of the Forest Service were getting reports constantly about all the fires that the indigenous people were burning. So people on the ground recognized it. And so to stop that, as the Spanish also did, you've got to figure out two things. How do you stop indigenous people from burning? And also, how do you stop others, white and non-indigenous folks, from copying them? So one of the ways, and it's both racially driven and also clever on the part of the Forest Service, is you denounce those whites who use fire as Paiute forestry. So
Right,
you
Paiute
label
fire strip. Right,
Paiute,
it's a
right?
very important concept in this book, and it's fascinating to
It's,
see it come out.
yeah. And because, and as I kind of snidely say in the text, like the worst thing you could call a white person, apparently, was an Indian. So one of the ways you make them, you diminish those who don't believe your position in the white community, your sort of posture or your ideology, is to say, well, you're just an Indian. Like, wow. You couldn't be both racist on the one hand and also discriminatory on the other. But so, and it's a language the Forest Service was quite happy to use because it wanted to win.
The Forest Service is a fascinating creation, and we can see it, come into being in this book. And I think I'd like you to talk about selecting the portions of text and finding them and selecting them. Was this all done electronically?
Yeah, because it was COVID and I couldn't get to any library. So there's an organization called the Hathi Trust, and anybody who's listening who knows about it knows it's one of these incredible digitizing organizations, effectively going through all sorts of libraries and digitizing whatever is possible. And thank God, one of the benefits of the pandemic, as it turns out, is they made it for free. You could get in there with, there was no paywalls and the like, and then you could copy it, which is even better for me. So I spent hours going through whatever I could that they had and other repositories had. And again, the University of Texas in Austin opened up its archive, and I found material in there. Other universities were doing similar kinds of things as a real gift to researchers. And I used that gift really, really extensively so that I could get this material. And then, as you can imagine, I had like five times whatever got into the book. And then the sort of editorial process kicks in which I need to, in my head, I need to balance voices and names and try to pull together both the mainline argument and also its critics. Which, as it turns out, was fairly easy to do because those critics were not marginal back in the day. They were being published in Sunset Magazine. They were being published in trade journals of the timber industry. The Pinchots and others had to fight against people inside the very industry they were allied with who were saying, you know what? I burn, and this is what the results are. And these are the ecological results as well as the profit that I make from those ecological services. That's a hard argument to confront. And frankly, they didn't snuff it out. And so that too has sort of reemerged in ways that ranchers were burning, miners were burning, loggers were burning because they recognized the value of that fire, as one of them put it, and it becomes one of the motifs in the text. Use fire as a tool, not an enemy. And if you use it as a tool, you actually benefit a lot more than if you thought of it as the enemy.
Don't let fire be the master. Make it your servant.
The servant. Right, right, right. That's a better framing of it. Don't let fire be the master. Make it a servant. And when you do that, you become quite aware of how the indigenous people understood fire to be. It helped serve their needs, and it produced a landscape with all of its riches that they wanted.
You also talk about there was a conflict within the Forest Service itself between the East and West Coast. On the East Coast, burning was very well accepted and understood because of the kind of pine species. So talk about the difference between the pine species on the East Coast and the West Coast and the way that affected the attitude towards burning.
Well, it's a complicated story, but one of the things that even in the late 19th century in Florida and elsewhere, those who were associated with the so-called forestry movement or the conservation movement recognized that longleaf pine, and there was long discussions about this, absolutely required fire to regenerate. It needed the heat to pop open the pine cones and the like, and that's how these processes unfolded. It was less pine in the West that led the story than what they called brush fields, by which they meant chaparral, by the way, which is the natural species. They assumed that chaparral took over areas where fire had swept through, wiping out timber. That's not really the case. Chaparral also needs fire, not as much as longleaf, but it also needs fire to regenerate. About roughly 80% of Southern California's mountains are chaparral, not pine. They always were, but you start reading some of the Forest Service people and they were going, that brush field. That brush field must have once had trees. No, it didn't. So their understanding of the terrain was, let's say, less robust and sophisticated than it could have been. But the argument in California about suppressing fire had almost less to do. Oh, so here's a way of thinking about it. One of the people that I quote in the introduction had taken a hike in the 1970s, and he walks up, and this is in the Northern California, the Klamath area. And he goes up into the mountains and sees something he's never seen before, which are ancient oak trees, many of them dead, but living under the canopy of the Douglas fir, the Doug fir forest. He's looking at that going, what the hell's going on here? Why are these things? And so he actually asked an archaeologist in the agency who said, well, those are ghost trees. This used to be an oak grassland, and that oak grassland was maintained by fire. Take out fire, the oaks lose out to the pine trees and essentially dominate it. And I saw that as a kind of metaphor for an indigenous landscape and a different form of landscape. One depended on fire, one depended on its absence. And there is the dialogue in California. We want pine, we don't want oak grasslands, because that's what the indigenous people benefited from. We're going to benefit from Doug fir. And so that's the conversion. Take out fire and you bring out this new forest. And so it's loaded in terms of sort of anti-indigenous fire management practices. It's loaded in terms of economic opportunity because Doug fir is more valuable than oak or grass in this case. But that Doug McCleary, who was the forester who went up there in the early 1970s, is someone I talked to about because he had this reference to it. And he said it changed his mind. It totally changed his mind about what he called the genocide that must have happened to make that process possible. And it's like, yeah, absolutely right. And so the story is complicated, but it is also genocidal and racial in terms of taking out fire produces one kind of economy and produces the value for one kind of people. And as Bill Tripp, who's up north, up in that neighborhood, who's a fire manager for the Kurukh people, articulates at the close of the book, like, putting fire back in the ground isn't just putting fire back in the ground. It's putting fire back in the ground on the hands of indigenous people to return those landscapes to once they want what they once were. It's a reclamation project.
One of the things that's really fun in this book is to find the characters who emerge. Mm. Like Gifford Pinchot, you mentioned him, and Joseph Kitts. Yeah. Talk about, for you, that must have been fun. After a while, did you start searching for, I mean, originally, how did you run your searches? Did you search for authors or subjects? And then once you immersed yourself in a subject, you found, oh, Kitts had a lot of interesting things to say. I'm going to look for this author.
Yeah. So with Kit, it just, I was looking in the Timberman, its own kind of funky industrial newspaper. And because they published several U.S. Forest Service folks in the late teens, early 20s, I went, huh, I wonder if there's anybody else in here. So I just started skimming, looking for under sort of keywords like fire, logging, some set of keywords that I utilized. And all of a sudden, Kit pops up. And I went, I don't know who this is, but this guy's really interesting. And, it, you know, I did a little biographical stuff with him. But his own words bear a different kind of story in which, you know, he and others of his kind and who had their own grassroots organizations managing fire in sectors of the country where the Forest Service was also trying to suppress it. It's like, oh my God, I knew there had to be people who were making these cases because who else is Pinchot and others writing against? But you know, here's this character who pops up and who, like others, are making the case for if you suppress fire, you're going to get what we in 2020, 21, 22 experience, which are massive fires. And I'm reading Kit's piece from 1920, and 100 years later, we're seeing the disadvantages that he was warning us about, the dangers that he was warning us about. So on the one hand, you know, he disappears from view. He's not a big player, but I wanted to give him space in part because he is the antidote to what his own contemporaries were saying. And he is for us a reminder that if we don't pay attention to fire as a tool, as a servant, we're going to have these fires that blow through Santa Cruz, that blow through Southern California, that blow through the Rockies and the Cascades. We're reaping the dangers that he was warning us about.
One of the things I found interesting was that fire itself could be used as a tool to control the landscape, but also regarded as the enemy that must be crushed. And to see the evolving argument in that, talk about orchestrating the historical documents to reflect the evolving argument. And also, we end up in the present, the current day.
Yeah.
And just like they knew in at the turn of the 20th century, that they knew they were right. We also know we're right, but the environment, we ourselves in the ensuing 120 years have radically changed the environment from where it was back in, at the turn of the century. So what might have worked had we started doing it 100 years ago might not work now. How certain are we now of the science that we have to hand?
Yeah, the dilemma for us, as it was for them, in a sense, was the relationship between science, policy, and politics. And for those of the listeners who are living in and around Santa Cruz, you know, you live in a daily basis in a landscape that is fire prone for a reason, because that's how that landscape has long been regenerated. And yet there's thousands of people who now live there. And so the human geography has encroached upon areas that were not well and thoroughly settled. And that changes the dynamic. So any puff of smoke that appears, in fact, there's a small fire burning just north of Claremont, where I am right now, up in the mountains, the San Gabriel Mountains. And they're hammering that thing, even though it's in a remote spot in an impossible area, slopes of 80%. They're attacking it because the worry always is in Southern California, if that thing escapes and comes flipping over the ridgeline and swoops into these valley towns, they have a problem. You know, with 20 million people in the Southern California region, you've got to fight fire in a very different way than it is fought or should be fought or could be fought elsewhere. But to go back to your original question, I mean, part of what the book is designed to do is to raise exactly the question you raised, which is how do we, using this historical infrastructure of material, these documents of various kinds, how do we now read them? And how do we then shape both our cultural responses to fire, the social infrastructure that we build to manage fire, and can we willy-nilly put fire back in the ground? The answer is, of course, no. And so, you know, don't take my word for it. Michael Connolly Misquish, who are the Kumeyaay people in eastern San Diego, made this case when he spoke at Pomona College a couple of years ago, makes this case in his article, which is why I had him write the article, the piece for me, for this book, that San Diego now is not San Diego in the 1800s when Crespi rolled through here. So what they were able to do, what the Kumeyaay were able to do then, they can't do now. But you can piece by piece do it. You can put ground fire on the ground and manage where it goes and how it goes. You can't broadcastly burn. And that's part of the process, because as Michael talks about in a series of other professional essays that he's written, you can use fire to restore watersheds. That's a social good on a campo or a reservation in eastern San Diego County, which can be extrapolated elsewhere. Fire helps us build resilient ecosystems, and you can do that. And I think part of it is that we are constrained by who we are and how we live. Which has been a large part of much of my sort of contemporary writing. But it doesn't mean you can't work at the edges. You can't nibble at the edges and start to sort of regenerate landscapes in one form or another. And I think we've got that responsibility, and we have that responsibility because the past shows us what mistakes we made.
One of the things I thought about as I read this book, especially the portions that were set around the early 1900s, was the onset of the conservation slash camping culture. I recently talked to a fellow named Martin Hoag, who wrote a book about the history of camping. And it was a lot of what he wrote about happened in the place he took was around 1905, 1930s. And one of the things that that book did effectively was it made me think that to a certain extent, camping hasn't changed a lot in 110 years in many ways, the way that people like to camp. And that it defines in a way our relationship to the land, the way we want to relate to the land versus the way we live. So talk about the idea, you know, of on one hand, the Indians and the Aboriginal lifestyle is not based around permanence, especially permanent habitation. It's moving from place to place where things are good. I mean, that's why humanity survived. Our Western civilization is based on moving one place and standing in your ground, as it were, against a fire, flood, or whatever else threatens your lifestyle.
Well, It's not exactly true that Native peoples of North America did not live in settlements, Cahokia in Illinois and elsewhere. I mean, these are 30,000 people.
Yeah, they didn't make some big... Yeah, I also talked to a fellow who did the history of the Mississippi River.
And there are clearly settlements, permanent settlements up and down the West Coast of Paiute and others, not the Paiute because they're more interior, but the Tongva and others had villages that were permanent in their basis. But one of the things to note is where they didn't live. And this is a way to think about that process, that they didn't live in floodplains and they didn't live in the foothills because they understood the dynamic between flood and fire, of drought and deluge. And so, you know, we ignore those signals and live where we damn well please and get flooded out and burned out as a consequence. And so maybe there's another lesson in here about watching, getting a sense for how people have lived on a landscape as opposed to the ways, well, frankly, I really, really want to live up in the foothills because, man, the view is great and I'm surrounded by trees, which we now think is as about as incendiary a move as one can have. So for me, sort of thinking about the lessons one pulls out of this text is to recognize and to go back to a point you made earlier about the sort of evolution of science, the evolution of social structures, the evolution of the geography, and I don't mean the physical geography, but the human geography that shaped decisions in ways that we thought at those moments when they were developed were permanent, and it turns out they're not. And you asked this question earlier, and I think the answer is, you know, is our science right? And I would argue Western science has gotten it really, really close to right. But there are all of these constraints, some of which is that there's just too many of us living in too few places and jam-packed in a compact way that makes it hard for the Western now science realization of indigenous knowledge to fully be implemented because of the dangers that implementation might well pose to what we call civilization.
And furthermore, we have destabilized the environment that had been stable for so long, so that we have created both, you know, especially, you know, in the climate change is real. It's new. Who knows what the heck's going to happen? Yeah. We make predictions and things move faster or slower than we expect.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And, you know, that's not an answer this book can give. But I think it's instructive to go back to our earlier conversation that once what was once thought to be sacrosanct no longer is. So why should we think the things that we think are grounded and material and vital will be true in a century from now? I suspect they won't be.
The new book by Char Miller is Burn Scars, A Documentary History of Fire Suppression from Colonial Origins to the Resurgence of Cultural Burning. Thank you for joining me, Char.
Oh, Rick, this was so much fun, and I really appreciate the chance to talk with you.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.